Hey everyone, welcome to The Restless Ones. I'm Jonathan Strickland. As always, my focus is on exploring the intersection of technology and business by having conversations with the most forward-thinking leaders. Throughout my career, I've covered everything from massive parallel processing to advanced robotics, but what truly inspires me are the stories of innovation and transformation. Today's guest is Mike Anderson, the CIO of Netskope. Mike was at the right place at the right time to learn some really valuable lessons in the tech space, becoming a co-founder of a company just as the dot-com craze was taking off in the 90s. An industry-defining disruption later, and Mike found himself honing his skills as a business leader before ultimately joining Netskope as CIO. Netskope is a cybersecurity company that aims to streamline client operations while providing top-level security. Leaders know that maintaining operations is a challenge in an increasingly complicated world. Once upon a time, a company might house all of its systems under a single roof. These days, with cloud services, distributed offices, and remote work all in the picture, it ensures that security takes a lot more effort. I sat down with Mike to talk about his perspective on security, the questions leaders need to ask in order to keep their companies, clients, and staff safe, and how emerging technologies like AI could have an impact on business in the future. But before jumping into all of that, I wanted to get to know Mike a bit better. Mike, welcome to The Restless Ones. We are so happy to have you on the show.
I am super excited to be a guest today and looking forward to the conversation.
Before we dive into everything that you're doing currently, I always like to get some background and get a better understanding of the path my guests took before they reached their current level in their career. So what initially drew you to the world of software development?
You know, I remember there was a presentation from one of these e-commerce companies back when I first started as a software developer. And a few of us said, wow, they're charging a lot for that software. We could go do that too and make a lot of money. So we went and started our own startup back in the dot-com days. Unfortunately, we got caught up in the whole dot-com bust as well, but I learned a lot. It was very early in my career. And that gave me experience beyond just being in technology, but dealing with a board of directors because I was the president of the company at a very young age. It's the challenges we have in life. It's the failures we have in life that if we learn from those, they shape who we are as a person. And so I wouldn't change anything. I wish it would have been super successful, but I learned so much and met so many great people through the process.
There's nothing like a trial by fire to really have you step up your skill set rapidly. I imagine that those lessons are ones that to this day remain relevant in your work.
It's interesting because it started in that software development side, but then I spent the better part of a decade as a business leader running sales engineering teams, technology practice, sales overlay organizations, being a GM for a system integrator, a VP of operations for Microsoft joint venture, until eventually I had a customer say, you know what? I ask you for advice all the time. We're looking for a CIO. You want to give that a shot? And so that was kind of my journey about a decade ago when I became a CIO, and I've been on that journey now for the past 10 years.
Wow. And so out of curiosity, were there any lessons learned as a software developer that are relevant, like seeing things from the other side, on the developer side, that inform your approach to leadership?
There is. So admittedly, you know, we also use the word shadow IT. I would say I was the shadow IT guy back when I was in the technology side, but I've always stayed close to tech, hobbying. And even as a CIO, my first CIO job, I was more in the weeds than I probably should have been just because I loved the technology. And so I would go learn things and then I would bring them back to my team and say, hey, have you looked at this? Have you thought about that? So even today, we think about generative AI. How do we think about our business and how do we use that? You know, what problems can we solve and how do we put the right guardrails around it? And so I think that technical understanding was helpful. Sometimes you get that question, like, what's your superpower? And I think the superpower for me is like, how do you take something super technical and then be able to translate it in terms that people that aren't technical can understand? How do you use analogies and storytelling to help people understand things better that don't have the technical depth? And I think living on both sides helped me get to where I'm at today.
I completely understand where you're coming from with that. I'm curious, how do you describe what your job is to someone else in a way that doesn't come across to them like a bunch of unrelated buzzwords that they can't quite parse?
The first thing I explain is what Netskope does, because a lot of people say, you mean Netscape? I'm like, no, I mean Netskope. If we think about any works at work, you're generally going to three destinations. You're going to a website, you're going to some software as a service application, like a Salesforce, or going to some application your company runs in their data center. The challenge is you want to make sure that you create a seamless experience for how people get to those things and make it a great experience so that you're not having to call someone to say something's not working. And so what we do is we create that secure, consistent, seamless experience for users connecting to all those applications without sacrificing the security that you need or the performance you want. And we also make sure that people can access more than they should. And so that's what I explain to people what we do without buzzwords. And then, you know, my job, I get the opportunity to lead an amazing team and be part of an amazing company, amazing culture to not only help with strategy, but also how we use our own technology internally and technology overall.
And as you point out, the landscape of how business is done today is so much more complicated than it was when we were both entering into the workforce. Back then, it was regular for a business to have pretty much all of its systems on premises. The word cloud computing had not really emerged into the mainstream yet. And now we're talking about work environments that can span multiple networks across multiple providers. So the need for a solution that creates a cohesive approach to all of this, that's absolutely critical. I can see how that is a crucial service in the way that business is run today.
No, absolutely. What happens in the consumer space always makes its way to influence what we do in the corporate world. So if you think back into the 90s, we used to go in the office and email was something you could only access when you were in the building. I remember I was using Novell GroupWise, you know, for people on the podcast, maybe listening, that was an old email platform before Microsoft Exchange and Gmail existed. But I remember we were like, I want to be able to access some of this stuff from home. I got my computer at home because I don't have a laptop, because we didn't have laptops. You had a desktop. So I had a desktop at home and a desktop at work. And we're like, well, I want to work some of that code at home. And so you would forward email to this new thing called Yahoo Mail and you'd get it there. Then people said, that's not secure. We can't have people forwarding their email. So what happened? All of a sudden now corporate email became accessible to people when they weren't in the office, right? And so we saw the same thing happen in mobile. We're seeing the same thing happen now with software as a service, right? It's users that are trying to solve a problem and they're bringing in an application to solve that problem. We basically had that data center. I had all my security stack, and a lot of companies have eight different products, eight different pieces of hardware bought from maybe eight different companies, sometimes the same company, but they were never meant to talk together, never meant to work together. And it just creates these speed bumps of complexity inside of our organizations. And so there's this opportunity to really take that, consolidate it, and leverage the new capabilities that we get. You know, use a buzzword, I'll use cloud, but basically deliver it where it doesn't have to be that hardware that I buy hardware based on my future demand, not what I need today. So I'm overbuying for what I need. It's like paying for the house, the lawn you're going to have in your future home, but even though you're in a smaller home today, I don't need that lawn service today, but I'm paying for it already. It's the same thing people were doing. So now I've got all that capability being delivered from the cloud, my supply and demand matches, and at the same time, it's creating an amazing employee experience because we're moving the tech closer to the user and not backhauling things to a central place to be able to run it through those eight speed bumps on the way out the door.
I'm very curious. We've talked about how businesses and the way to do business has gotten much more complicated. I think one of the things that really has transformed businesses in a truly disruptive way is wireless connectivity. How has that been reflected in the security sector? Because we've seen what it's doing for creating new business opportunities, but what sort of effects does that have on the security side?
Yeah, it's a great question. When you look at today, anytime you connect from home, like the traditional way we've all done it is when I'm trying to access my ERP system or whatever application inside my company, I connect my VPN on. It gives me an IP address that's now on the network. So my device in my home over that wireless network is now connected on that network, and it can route anywhere on the network once it's there. Now, I could try to go create some complexity and firewall rules to head that off, but you know, there's a lot of overhead associated to that. If you think about, there's the word zero trust out there. The idea being, if I'm from home, I don't want people to have a routable IP address to get anywhere on my network, because what happens if they've got their kid upstairs playing, you know, Roblox, and they're using some bot that's not really safe, and all of a sudden it's compromising, it's attacking my company. This is word attack surface we use in security. Every one of those people connected via VPN is part of my attack surface. If I'm at a coffee shop on an unsecure network at a Starbucks, that's part of my attack surface. And so that's the challenge that it's created. And then I take that same computer I was in the Starbucks with and I take it back into my office and I've got full connectivity to everything. Now, all of a sudden, I've got this different experience, different access, depending on where I'm working from. And really, if we think about it, We want that secure access wherever someone's working from. And if you apply, one of the core tenets of Zero Trust is don't trust any network. Mm-hmm. And so if you talk to the CIOs and the CISOs that are down this path, they've basically said, my offices are like a Starbucks now. I only give people access to the apps they need and nothing more. One of the problems is, how do I give that access to applications without giving people access to the network? And make sure it's consistent if I'm working from home on my wireless connection, working over 5G in my car in the middle of a parking lot, or I'm working at my company's office. We want that to be the seamless, consistent experience across both those without having more access than you should.
Excellent. One of the things I think is really interesting is, as we're seeing evolutions in things like wireless connectivity, we're seeing some consideration being put forward towards security, even just in those technologies at a baseline before we start adding on top of that. Could you speak a bit to some of the security advantages that 5G presents compared to previous generations of wireless technology?
I have the fortune of being on the advisory board for T-Mobile for Business, right? And they're obviously pushing a lot in the 5G space. The big piece I think that 5G allows is it allows opportunities to bring workloads closer to the users, closer to where decisions need to be made. Before, I was reliant on how much of a circuit could I pay for connected to an office or a building, or how fast is the internet access? Like, look at my home. I love my gigabit connection, but why do I have a 50 meg? Because I can't always trust my gigabit connection. So that 5G presents another path that doesn't require someone to bury things under the ground. Now, there are things where you can do private networks and things like that. We see those in the federal government a lot, where we can leverage things like 5G or a private 5G network. But even in that, you want to layer on top of that. So if I have an IoT device, how do I make sure that's only talking to things I want it to talk to? Because if I see all of a sudden see that camera in my building or that camera in an oil field, all of a sudden someone else is taking control of it, I want to be able to see that and restrict that and block it and make sure that that doesn't lead into a vulnerability in the rest of my environment. And so 5G creates a great path and opens up new business opportunities, but we also have to layer the security on top of that to make sure that we can only allow things to access, whether it's a person or device, the things they should.
Yeah, I remember when we started talking about big data, it was in a time where it was all about the collection, but we didn't really have great ways to analyze information. Obviously, that has gone by leaps and bounds since then. But on the flip side, to your point, the Internet of Things also represents considerations you have to make when it comes to security, because we've seen time and again in the consumer world, even how Internet of Things devices can sometimes allow unwanted intruders access to your home. We have to remember that the devices we're connecting to our networks, while they might be incredible and add value, we have to do it in a way that continues to keep security front of mind.
No, 100%. And it's an interesting topic. And there's a corollary here, which is, you know, we always say we're only as strong as our weakest link. And so even though one product that we put in our home can have the best security possible if it's used right, but the problem is when it's not put in the optimal environment, we always say there's a happy path in software, right? Well, people do things we don't expect them to do. Mm-hmm. And it's those types of settings and configurations and things we do that create that risk for us. And so we see that today. I was with the former chief of staff for CISA. For those who aren't familiar with CISA, they're focused on our critical infrastructure security. And it's one of the largest federal agencies in that space. If you think about all of our businesses, at some point, we are dependent on some small business to provide some part or some capability or some service for us today. And those companies don't have the budgets, the people, the knowledge to be able to get the right level of security we need them to have. And so we have a social responsibility as an industry to help all of those companies, because again, we're only as strong as our weakest link. And so how do we help them be more secure? Because there's more small businesses in the world than there are large ones.
To that point, how do you think leaders should approach security? What questions should they be asking and seeking answers as they're building out their security strategy?
First question I ask is, where are you on your identity journey? Because first and foremost, I need to prove I know who that person is and be able to then reprove that that's really that person if I see something that looks anomalous in what they're doing. The second piece is then, you know, where we're starting to come in, there's this term called Secure Access Service Edge. And as part of that, there's a subcomponent called Security Service Edge. And if you look at some of the guidance from NIST, they basically created this, what they call Zero Trust Architecture. So we took the Zero Trust term and principles and put architecture with it, and they gave people a guidepost. And if you look at that, there's this policy enforcement point that sits between users and devices and everything they want to access, whether it's an application, a resource, data, whatever that is. And so I tell people those are two very critical pieces is to have that policy enforcement point, but you have to have identity with it because that informs, I know who the person is. And then each thing you add to that, whether it's something on the endpoint, like a CrowdStrike, how are we communicating to an Okta or a Ping or a Microsoft? How do we have a better together story? So when you think about security, make sure you ask the question, how did all these things connect together? How do I make sure that the investment I made in my identity is going to work with the investment I'm making in my security service edge? And so that's a critical component of that. Then let's go with the remote users. We talked about working on wireless from home in the coffee shop. That's a great place to start. Let's get them in the right order. And then next, let's go to my branch offices and look at how do I get my branch offices where I can almost treat them like they're a Starbucks coffee shop. Then I go to my headquarters locations and I deploy the technology within my network. So there's parts of that cloud piece that come down into my network so that I can have that same experience inside of my headquarters. And then to the extent that I've got factories or plants or distribution centers, then I take it to that. And at that point, I'm trying to make sure that that machine vision software that's sitting in the server room that's inspecting a circuit board to make sure there's no defects that needs 1 millisecond latency in order to be able to keep the manufacturing line running, I can support that. So that's kind of the journey that I recommend to people they go about when they're thinking about how they implement. And the other piece is think about like, what is the part of your world that would hurt the most if someone were to take it down? Because you can't do everything at once. Start there and then work down that list. Use an agile mindset as you apply security. Get the thing that's going to have the most pain attached to it. Address that one first and then move forward from there.
You've touched on a lot of things that I would love to dive into further. Netskope has several clients who are in the healthcare industry. Clearly, healthcare has incredibly sensitive security issues, right? Where you have patient data, which needs to be as private and secure as it gets. And you're talking about a mission critical element. And we've seen that healthcare organizations can often be prime targets for bad actors because they are aware this is a life and death organization. So can you talk a little bit about the threats that health organizations face and how Netskope actually helps protect against those threats?
It's a great question. You know, the first thing when you look at healthcare, I mean, because healthcare is a broad category, when you think about hospital environments, you know, we heard this concept of IT/OT that's so present in hospitals. The OT in that world, it's the dialysis machine. It's the robot that the doctor is using, right? So the key piece is making sure you have the right level of segmentation between those devices that are critical to patient care and then the place where you store the data, which in the hospital world is going to be your EMR. So it's your Epic or your Cerner that you're going to be using. You've then also got all these systems that are out there in the software as a service space. It may be your HR system like a Workday. It could be a Salesforce. So a good example that we apply inside healthcare and inside Netskope as well is when there's an employee that's exiting the organization, I want them to be able to put their information in. I don't want to stop them from being able to get their job done, but I want to stop any activity that lets them downloading data to their local machine or taking data with them. And so we can instrument that automatically for customers. So if we trigger off their HR system, it puts someone into an Active Directory group that then we can key off of that says, okay, any of these critical SaaS applications block downloads of data. But then take it a step further, because we know that most people take data 13 days before they resign. Most people don't take it after they put their notice in because they expect they're on the watch list. But now I can go back and look and see what are all the download activity and upload activity that person's had for the past 90 days, you know, especially the past month. And so that lets me understand, did someone do something that I didn't want them to do then? But then let's take it a step further, right? And this applies cross industry, ChatGPT. So you've got someone that says, you know what? I just wrote up all these notes about this patient. Let me organize them better. So let me just post them into my ChatGPT and see if I can get them organized better. Well, that can create a lot of concern because that's now all that information, depending on which ChatGPT I'm going to. Am I going to OpenAI that's a paid version, or am I going to the web browser version I'm paying for? All of a sudden, that data is in the public domain. So what we're doing is inspecting that data as it's being posted into ChatGPT. And if it has anything that's considered PII about that patient, it's going to block them from transmitting that information into ChatGPT. I can also warn people and say, oh, that's not a corporate instance of ChatGPT. That's the free version. Here's the acceptable use policy for how you use this. One of the things that I think we all say in the security space, that the issue is not the technology. We can have the best security tools, but if we don't address the person in the chair between the keyboard, that's a weak link. And so what I struggle with is we use this once a month, once a year, once a quarter security awareness training. And we expect people to take it once and remember it. And if you remember earlier, I said about analogies, I tell people, it's like we get in our car today. We don't pull out our map to figure out where we're going to go in our destination. When we get to the airport and get a rental car, we don't say, let me get the map so I can look at it. We go, no, I just type an address in my phone. And if there's an accident, it guides me around it. If there's a police ahead, it says, you know, you may want to slow down. What's our GPS for our users when they're going about the world? I'm on the internet, I'm surfing. There's a lot of destinations out there. And to me, one of the key things and problems we're solving at Netskope is we're providing a GPS for people. Don't go to that site. We already have an application that does that. Don't bring another one in. They may not know. People don't read emails and go to app catalogs to find stuff. They just find things. They go to Google. So it's how do I give that GPS to my users so that they have a way to navigate the entire world of the internet and my applications without relying on reading emails, attending a webinar, or remembering something from an annual or quarterly or monthly security awareness training.
Gosh, Mike, you hit so many things. Bringing up AI, you know, that one application of AI and how that represents a security vulnerability. I'm curious what you think about AI from the broader perspective of security, both potentially on the pro-security side of using AI to do things like perhaps even identify an intrusion attempt, or maybe on the flip side, because we're starting to hear reports about people leaning on tools like generative AI in order to craft new types of malware. There's a lot of conversation. It's very hard to separate the truth from the speculation. So I'm curious to hear from an expert what your perspective is on the topic.
When it first came out, we said, okay, kind of like you have toys in the sandbox. Let's go put it in the sandbox and let's learn as much as we can about it, not only for our internal use, but also for how we can guide our customers. Because we need to stay on top of what the new threats are that are coming out and how these are being applied. We're looking at different use cases. For example, internally, the pro things is, how can I take friction out? We're all challenged with talent, training people. So once I implement technology, what can I do to eliminate how much effort it takes to keep it running? So that's a big point. And I've been in a lot of these roundtables in the last few months on generative AI. And you can take one approach and say, from a security standpoint, you can block it. But when you do that, you're blocking innovation. You can enable it, but then you're opening yourself up to security and vulnerabilities. How do you govern it and allow people to innovate in a secure way is the key piece. It's really about how do we educate our people. It goes back to that GPS conversation, just telling people, this is a free version. Whatever you put in here goes in the public domain and everyone else in the world is going to see it. I don't think people think about that because they don't study this topic. But I think there's so many advances that we can do around how we can use it to make some of these routine decisions. Or I think about financial analysts, right? Why do we have financial analysts? Because they tell us what the data means. Well, if I can now use things like generative AI to look for the anomalies of data and tell me what it means, you know, we've seen that in some of the natural language based tools out there from Tableau and AnswerRocket and ThoughtSpot. How does that now take that to a whole new level? How do we change the way we provide service to our internal employees? You look at a company like MoveWorks. They've been doing some amazing things around how do we provide better service to employees and get them what they need without making them wait on a ticket and wait for someone to respond, right? And so I think those areas where we can reduce friction in our companies and then help the analysis happen faster, I think are going to be key ways that we can leverage generative AI for positive ways.
It's such a young technology too. I mean, it's been in development for years, but really when we're looking at generative AI that is truly working on an impressive level, we're talking about a technology that's just a couple of years old. And really, in the last 6 months, we've seen stratospheric development in the space. I am also curious, what's your approach to evaluating a technology? Like, how do you do things like identify risk versus the value added of a new technology?
There's a couple of pieces there. You know, I always encourage my peers to keep a pulse on what's going on in the startup land. We see that disruption there. So always learn, like for example, generative AI, or a year ago, we were all talking about metaverse. And then before that, it was blockchain, right? So if you think about how do you learn about it? Because you're probably going to get asked, you know, your CEO is probably going to ask you, hey, what do you think about this? The best thing to do is understand what problems can it solve? Oftentimes we get a technology we get enamored with and it's like we're running around with a hammer and everything looks like a nail and we're trying to figure out how we can solve it with our hammer. And so the first thing, the most important thing is understand the business problems that you're trying to face and then ask yourself, does that technology help address the problems that you're experiencing in your world today? Or ask the vendor, what are the problems you're solving for other people? Because they talk to a lot of different companies and learn. And that's a coaching I give to every startup out there is, don't tell me about the cool feature you have. Tell me about the outcome you're going to deliver. What's the business problem I'm going to be able to solve that I couldn't solve before? And so that's one of the key things. So once you've centered on that, Then the next piece is really then vetting the security. You know, is it running in the right place? Have they got the right safeguards? Have they got the right security environment? I'm fortunate that I have an amazing peer as our CISO in Lamont Orange that's, you know, his team does an amazing job partnering to make sure we're doing safe innovation inside the company. And so I encourage people to make sure that you partner with your security teams and leaders to make sure that you're working in tandem to go evaluate those technologies again so you can do safe innovation, safe enablement across your organization.
Before I could let Mike go, I needed to ask him one more thing. What's the best piece of advice you have ever received?
Yeah, I actually had a VP of marketing, and she ended up becoming what I would consider a member of my personal board of directors. And she said, hey, I know you want to go start another company. She goes, but if you'll invest the time, I'll teach you all the things you need to know to be successful in your career and business. Now, we all get these ideas that we think are the best idea, the best way to solve a problem. And she was trying to give me, again, you know, teaching. She said, next time you have a big idea, I want you to sit down and think about what are the alternative ways to solve the same problem? What are the other ideas that could potentially be used? And I want you to put the same energy into those as you do are the one that you came up with. And then I want you to come present those to me. And I don't want to be able to know which one that is the one you're most passionate about or which one was the idea you came up with first. The reason that was such a good piece of advice was because when you're presenting things, we always have a bias for our idea, but we need to include the ideas of others around us. And so that advice has helped me throughout my career because it allows us to have the view of other people. And then ultimately, if you present the facts, the best idea will come forward. And it may not be the one you came up with the first time. There may be a better approach.
It's very similar to my personal philosophy, which is that I never want to assume I'm the smartest person in the room. And so far, that hasn't been a problem because I'm around a lot of really smart people. Mike, thank you once again for joining The Restless Ones. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a true honor to talk to you. Hopefully, we have a conversation again in the future.
Thanks again to Mike Anderson of Netskope for joining the show. I think Mike's practical approach toward security is something we should all take to heart, even on an individual level. And it's great to know that companies like Netskope are out there as a partner to help businesses achieve results while keeping operations secure. And I'm thankful that Mike emphasized that it's just as important to not let concern prevent companies and people from embracing innovation. That if we try to hold off on taking advantage of innovation, we can miss out on opportunities. There must be a balance between incorporating new solutions while also protecting the business. Yes, we must be concerned about introducing vulnerabilities, but not to the extent that we talk ourselves out of trying new things. Join us for more episodes of The Restless Ones this season as we talk with more forward thinkers and pioneers. Until next time, I'm Jonathan Strickland.